This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up later on the show, our news director, Dave Thompson, joins us to preview the upcoming political debates, as well as do a deep dive into the news week that was. And Madeline reviews the movie Papillon. But first, we are going to talk about the Faith, Reason, and World Affairs Symposium that is coming up September 18th and 19th on the campus of Concordia College in Moorhead. And this year's symposium theme is called Power Plays, Why Gender Matters. And the featured speakers are some very heavy hitters indeed. And joining me now is Rebecca Walker, the author and featured speaker at this symposium. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
As I mentioned, the symposium theme, Power Plays, Why Gender Matters. So this title sort of indicates there is still an out-of-balance power structure. When you hear a term like gender equality, what all, and maybe this will take our whole 25 minutes, does that encompass for you?
Oh, that would take a whole 25 minutes, perhaps. But, I mean, you know, the most basic definition of gender equality is, you know, as we understand it, is equal treatment of all human beings, irrespective of their anatomy or gender identity or sexual preference or any of the other differences that we know exist between the great variety of beings that are walking this planet. So, you know, the idea, you know, to bring it down to the micro level is just to ensure that men and women and transgender people are treated equally in terms of what they're paid, how their bodies are respected, how their issues are addressed, how much power, how much value, how much intentionality is put toward making sure that the lives of women are as good and productive and safe as they can possibly be, coming out of the context of at least, I don't know, what would we say now, at least 800 years of serious patriarchy in which women's bodies and lives and work have been so incredibly devalued.
The symposium, you can read about it at concordiacollege.edu/symposium, and a write-up on that website says that you will be setting the stage for the first evening by diagnosing the problem, and I should mention that you will be speaking from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at Concordia with a book signing to follow, and the title is called Stuck at the Intersection, Can Feminism Survive the Traffic? What does that title mean?
Well, as many people who've been following feminism for the last few decades know, the vision for contemporary feminism has to do with intersectionality. So when we talk about intersectionality, we talk about understanding the ways in which oppressions are stacked and the ways in which we need to respond to these stacked oppressions in a way that can support all women moving forward. So if you are a black lesbian woman, you have not only gender discrimination, you have homophobia to deal with, and you have racism to deal with. So for feminism to actually address the needs of women of color, gay women, those concerns must be included within feminism. We're at a point right now, just in this exact moment, in which we are seeing, you know, as we know, 53% of white women voters voted for Trump, which means that 53% of white women, many of whom would consider themselves feminists, voted not just for a misogynist, rapist, but also for a white supremacist. And someone who is, you know, blatantly disregards the needs of the poor, who is against prison reform, which we know disproportionately affects people of color, et cetera, and so on. So we've got a problem there. And then on the other hand, we have just recently one of the organizers of the Women's March, who has been pilloried for her affiliation with Farrakhan, who, as we know, is, you know, homophobic and among other things. And so the dream of feminism to be able to bridge the gap between those white women who voted for Trump and these women of color who feel affiliated with homophobic leaders, you know, that is sort of happening in many different places. So we have, you know, Latina leaders who are fighting for their biggest issue, which is not to be deported, you know, and to have immigration reform, to get DACA signed. So, you know, how can feminism address that? So then we've, you know, so we've got this sort of intersectionality. The dream is that white women of privilege would lend their privilege to women of color who are fighting for gun control, prison reform, because that's their feminist issue. We've got Black women who are hoping that they can have women who are fighting for DACA and immigration rights come over to their side and fight for gun control. You know, that's the vision of intersectionality. And yet, what's happening right now is that there is this vision, this ideal, and it's a little bit stuck because we can't quite get over the real differences that people have. You know, I mean, it's very hard for, you know, say Black feminists to support the needs and issues of white feminists who voted for Trump, whose issues, you know, whose mandate is definitively against their needs. So I'm going to be talking just about what we can do to try to further the vision of intersectionality, further this hope that we can all sort of allow ourselves different points of view but still be working toward a social justice system that can work for all. I'm not sure if it's possible at this point, but I'm definitely going to be outlining some strategies that I think can help us get through this kind of gridlock that we seem to be at. You know, I was just looking at some of the footage from the Women's March after the election and feeling this great, you know, this hopeful coming together of women from all different positions and, you know, men who are deeply involved and committed showing up. And really the question is, you know, can we actually continue to mobilize at that level, or will we be splintered and let go of some of the power and momentum that comes out of transcending our own individual identities on behalf of a greater good?
Well, when you say something like you're going to be outlining strategies for moving forward, and I'm wondering in particular how a location on a college campus might impact what message is delivered. Would you be giving this same speech at Concordia's campus as you might be giving at, you know, an inner city rally? Do you tailor your message depending on where you're speaking?
What an interesting question. I think in 25 years, I haven't had that question. I think you definitely, one definitely does think about the audience. I've spoken at, you know, 300-400 universities over the course of my career, and I find that university campuses are really, you know, the students tend to be very open. They are looking for answers. They want a better world. They're in their sort of formative years, so there's a sense of planting seeds, even if the specificity of what you're saying isn't actionable for them at that very moment. There's a sense that it will bloom in their minds at some point. They will reckon. They will wrestle. And I've seen that bear out. You know, I'm always running into people who say, oh, I heard you speak when I was, you know, a junior, and you know, I didn't quite understand what you were saying then, but eventually I did, and it changed my life. You know, I started to do this, I started to do that. So there's a sense of a sort of hopefulness. I mean, I always want to be someone who brings a message of, yes, there's a problem, but yes, it can be fixed. Yes, there's a problem, but you are part of the future, and it's yours to grapple with and to come up with a better outcome for us. Now, that is different, I would say, from, you know, meeting with elected officials, which I also do, meeting with, you know, the leaders of massive social media companies, which I also do. And those talks are much more sort of directive, immediate, asking for them to be involved and engaged in solving these problems right now, every day, because they're making decisions every day that affect millions of people. So, yeah, I would definitely say that there are adjustments that are made for different communities. And then even when you're speaking at a rally, you know, the intention and the need at a rally is to sort of energize, to focus on the fact that we are a collective, and that if we can use our energy and our day-to-day sort of power to march, to walk, to speak out, then we can create change in that way. So that's a different message with a different level of urgency. College campuses are usually places where there's room for reflection. It's a very privileged location, and yet I think singularly important, because there can be this kind of time to think and talk and reflect and grapple and really plant seeds. I mean, a lot of the students take what I say and build on it. You know, they alter, they agree with some things, they disagree with some things, and they come up with something much better than I could even imagine, you know? So yes.
We are visiting with author and activist Rebecca Walker. She will be speaking on the campus of Concordia College in Moorhead on Tuesday the 18th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. with a book signing to follow as part of the symposium, the Faith, Reason, and World Affairs Symposium, and it's called Power Plays, Why Gender Matters. And Rebecca, your website is rebeccawalker.com. So the Me Too movement got going more than a decade ago, but has really picked up steam in the last 18 months or so, where a lot of powerful men have lost their jobs based on accusations of rape and sexual harassment. And this is really quite a change from what really put you on the map as a third wave feminist leader, which is going back to 1992, when you wrote the Becoming the Third Wave essay in response to Clarence Thomas being appointed to the Supreme Court despite allegations of sexual harassment. How has the Me Too movement impacted your work?
It's a great question. You know, Tarana Burke and the Me Too movement has been, you know, very important, obviously, right now. But one of the things that we started when we began doing Third Wave was a fund. You know, we found out that only 3% of philanthropic dollars were going toward young women and young women's issues, and so we decided to transition from a direct action organization to a philanthropic organization that actually could give money to young women who were fighting for social justice in their communities. And one of our grantees was Tarana Burke, 10, I don't know how many years ago, at least a decade ago, when she began doing her work. So it's been wonderful to feel, again, this is like when you speak somewhere or you do your activism in different locations, how it makes an impact. You know, the idea that we were able to give her the money that helped contribute to the movement that she has spearheaded is very gratifying, and it's a real illustration of the ways in which generations of feminism is really, you know, the way to go, making certain that you know, we are creating connections between women. So yes, the Me Too movement, as it has developed, is definitely more, I guess we can call it more successful, in that it is stripping many men of the power that they had. And, you know, unfortunately, we were not able to shut down the hearings for Clarence Thomas, and we've now been the victims of his decisions, you know, since he was installed. So I think that if Me Too was as strong then as it is now, we would have had a very different outcome. Though under Trump, I'm not quite sure I can say that, but certainly it would have been a different outcome. And I guess, you know, I see it in terms of this evolution. You know, we, in 1992, when we were supporting Anita Hill, we were building on the work of second wave feminists who had talked about workplace discrimination, had talked about sexual assault, had talked about sexual violence, and, you know, and they had created language that didn't exist before then, you know, and they created the expectation that women should be able to go to work and not be harassed and assaulted. And so when we were there supporting her, we were doing what we had sort of learned was appropriate to do, and we were hoping to further that into the future. And so going from there to funding Tirana to now seeing the sort of, you know, this new wave of the movement is very gratifying, and it's great to feel that, you know, you put in all of this time, and you can actually see results. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that we started Third Wave was, you know, this kind of, you know, seeing a lot of our feminist, womanist foremothers kind of, you know, exhausted from all the work they had done. And, you know, we had a real understanding, and I kind of had a crisis, but a real reckoning with this about 5 or 7 years ago, this idea that, you know, I've put so much of my life into these issues, and, you know, you get a president like Trump, and you see the rise of conservatism, and you can see the wiping out of all of the work that you've done. You know, if we lose Roe v. Wade, if we lose affirmative action, if we lose gay, lesbian, same-sex marriage, you know, then there's this sense of futility, you know, and does social change really matter? And working for social change. But when you see this evolution and this groundswell now, it gives you hope, and it reaffirms that we can and we should be doing as much as we can, because, as I've always said, I think you might be able to change laws, but I think you'll never change consciousness, you know, fully. I think you can't reverse that. Once you raise people's awareness of what is just and what should be, and you change their minds in a very deep way, it's hard to put all of that back in the bottle. And so I think a lot of us have, you know, spent time fighting for laws and fighting for policy, but also just fighting to help people, you know, open themselves, open their minds, you know, have more compassion, see that human beings of all backgrounds are deserving of support and opportunity. And so I think this is a great example of that. Even in the midst of a Trump presidency, the consciousness that women should be treated equally is there.
I think that you have answered parts of this question here and there, but who and what are you watching in fourth wave feminism?
That's an interesting question. I, you know, again, one of the things that was important for us with Third Wave was this idea of decentralizing leadership, that feminism would never be as powerful as it needs to be if we're looking at one or two or three leaders. And, you know, so I'm looking at all of the feminisms that are alive and well. I'm looking at the women who are, you know, fighting for DACA, who are fighting against deportation. You know, those are the Latina feminist leaders that I embrace. I'm looking at the women of color, the white women, all, you know, the students, you know, from Parkland, the students who are marching for their lives against, you know, this incredible proliferation of guns in our country, and who are demanding, you know, stronger measures to restrict gun availability. I see those as, you know, feminist, womanist warriors out on the front lines. I see all of the queer activists who are trying at different levels to make space for transgender people, to transform the language around gender, as sort of frontline activists in that area. So I'm looking at a big picture. I'm looking at intersectionality, really, and I'm looking at groups of people, at micro-movements. I guess I could say that I'm also looking at the electorate. I'm looking at Ocasio-Cortez. I'm looking at Kamala Harris. I'm looking at the 19 incredible African-American judges, lawyers who are, you know, running for judgeships in Georgia. You know, I'm looking at the students like Emma Gonzalez. I'm taking a lot of inspiration from, Cynthia Nixon. You know, last night she lost the primary for governor of New York, which was very sad, but she articulated a very important progressive vision. You know, her platform was incredible. She made some statements, you know, specifically about the legalization of marijuana that I thought were, you know, deeply important for a white woman of privilege in New York to make. She talked about how legalizing marijuana is a racial justice issue and that marijuana has effectively been legal for white people in New York for generations and that it's only black and Latino people who are imprisoned based on possession. You know, to talk about that and to say that their records should be expunged, to say that the money that will be gotten as tax revenue from legalizing marijuana in that state should be given to rebuild the lives of those whose lives were taken by being imprisoned for carrying, you know, a gram of marijuana. And that's a very important platform, and I see that platform as being completely in sync with and an outgrowth of the feminist movement of the last 30 years that has emphasized intersectionality and putting one's own privilege on the line on behalf of other women.
Well, Rebecca, I'm sad to say that we are out of time. Rebecca Walker is an activist, author, and speaker who will be at the Faith, Reason, and World Affairs Symposium September 18th and 19th at Concordia College. You can find out more at concordiacollege.edu/symposium. Rebecca will be speaking Tuesday from 7:30 to 9 p.m. with a book signing to follow, and that website also for more of Rebecca's work is RebeccaWalker.com. Rebecca, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, Madeline reviews Papillon, but now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. American Crystal officials say investments aimed at reducing odors emanating from the East Grand Forks plant are proving successful, but they come at a cost. ACS plant manager Lloyd Kennedy says since 2006, the sugar company has invested nearly $40 million in environmental treatment efforts. Kennedy says handling and treating water is a major portion of the company's business.
Sugar beets are typically, on average, 76 to 77% water, which for East Grand Forks, that equates to over 450 million gallons of water that we bring into our plant every processing season. You know, some of that we evaporate, some of it we condense into clean water, but some of it has to go through our water treatment plant.
Kennedy briefed the East Grand Forks Council this week on the investments, calling it an ongoing effort.
A huge amount of technology out there that applies to our industry. We're quite a bit different than municipal treatment plants and other industries in the amount and strength of the water that we deal with. So it's a lot of the stuff that we had to invest and look at. We're learning as we go.
East Grand Forks officials say smell complaints are way down. The all-out beet harvest will begin October 1st. Company officials say it looks to be another solid crop year. Valley City State University is one step closer to having a new president. After a final round of ongoing campus interviews this week, a search committee has narrowed the list of five candidates down to three. The names will be brought to the State Board of Higher Education, with the new president possibly being selected from the group. Greg Steeman is a member of the Board of Higher Education and co-chairs the search committee. He says it took a great deal of time and thought to get to this point. He says the committee had a strong field of applicants to work with.
There are individuals that have worked or are working at institutions that have similar profiles. and maybe, you know, in this region have backgrounds or experience in this region working at similar types of institutions. A couple of them have had some long tenures at their existing institutions and have been extremely selective about where they've looked for additional career opportunities. The third candidate has worked previously up in this area, also spent some time outside of higher education before he got back into higher education. There are some similarities and there's some things that are unique about each candidate that the committee found valuable and interesting.
The committee will interview the three candidates. They will be interviewed by the Board of Higher Education in 2 weeks. And the Legislative Procedures and Arrangements Committee is now on record supporting pay raises for state employees. The committee approved a proposal to give legislative branch employees 2% raises each year of the upcoming biennium. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg of Grand Forks made the motion to put money for those raises in the branch's budget proposal.
We are sending a message that the legislature feels state employees deserve a pay raise. 4 years is too long to go in the job market we have in North Dakota without making adjustments to pay.
Governor Burgum has said he also believes state employees deserve pay raises. Holmberg says the legislative branch had to include something in its budget proposal before Burgum decides on his pay plan. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives. And by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
And that noise can only mean one thing. It is time for our in-depth news discussion with News Director Dave Thompson. Dave, thanks as always for stopping by Main Street.
You are very welcome, Ashley.
And you, well, you always have busy weeks, but you had an especially busy week, and you have an especially busy, I don't know, 8 weeks from now until the midterms.
Oh, yes. The elections are going to be top of mind for a lot of things.
Yep, you are just going to need one of those portable IVs full of caffeine because you have been doing a lot of debate coverage. Give us a quick recap of some of the debates that you covered this week and then preview what's coming up.
And we started last week, of course, with the PSC debate, and we had the issue there and we talked about that last week. This week, I came to do the debate Tuesday night, the two House candidates, and at the end of the debate, I said that I thanked them for what I called a spirited yet respectful debate. And I thought it was very spirited at times. They did clash on some issues. They did find some common ground. But it was very respectful because it was about the issues. It wasn't about personalities. And I really liked that. And I've been doing some off-air producing. You know, if you call somebody who has an IFB talking to the other host, Matt O'Lean, that's a producing that I was working on some of that to give them time cues, things like that. So
interruptible
it's been busy.
Feedback for anyone who doesn't
feedback.
Know what IFB means.
Yes, that is. And I was a timekeeper on the Secretary of State debate, which was Wednesday.
Okay. And how do you think that one went?
I thought that went well, but, you know, we had the issue. There were three candidates who were qualified to be on the race. You had the Democrat, Josh Prochet, and you had two independents, the incumbent, Al Jager, and then you had Michael Coachman, who was also an independent. So we had to change some things about how it was set up, how it looked on television, and we only had a half hour. So it went very fast, and they did get into some discussions of the issues. And I always think that debates on that format, they're not real true debates, but they are chances for candidates to get issues out and talk about the issues. And I was kind of glad there was some back and forth between the candidates in both debates.
What do you mean when you say debates in that format are not true debates?
Well, if you look at, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they actually had time to look at each other and ask each other questions, challenge each other directly. That happened a little bit, especially in the House debate, but it wasn't asking each other questions. They would challenge each other directly. So the moderator was less important. In our modern debates, what we call debates, the moderator is more important because the moderator keeps it going with questions and with time and move on to the next subject.
You know, I know we have been doing a push to get more questions from Prairie Public listeners and viewers. Have we been getting a lot of audience participation in this?
We have been getting some, but I think, you know, in 2 years, I think it'll be better once we get more and more. And we'll probably even get started earlier. Hey, we have debates coming up. Are there questions you'd like to see us ask these candidates?
And for anyone out there who is listening who does want to contribute, how do they contribute questions to future debates?
Go to our website and I think maybe go to our Facebook page. Do I have that right?
I believe so.
It is Facebook. That you can actually, you know, say these are the questions we'd like to hear answered. And we have some debates coming up, especially we have the U.S. Senate debate between Republican Kevin Cramer and Democratic incumbent Heidi Heitkamp. That's coming up on October 5th. Chance to get a couple questions in there. Also, if you're in our Minnesota audience, 7th District Congressman, that debate is coming up fairly soon, too, in October.
And that Senate debate, we did talk about this a bit last week. PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff, she's the anchor of that program. She's going to be coming to co-moderate that debate, again, because the North Dakota Senate seat very much in the national profile for this year. And speaking of national news coming out of North Dakota, NPR's Jim Zaroli, who is a New York-based reporter primarily in business and in trade, he was traveling to North Dakota this week and covering Big Iron.
I thought that was extremely interesting. I heard one of his reports. And, you know, this is interesting because we have the whole trade dispute and try to renegotiate trade deals. So it does put another spotlight on North Dakota. And, of course, Big Iron is a good place to come because that's a lot of farm equipment that's being sold and traded. And, you know, people who represent commodity groups actually go to these things, too. So I think it's very interesting. And you did have a chance to talk to him.
I did, yeah. And I thought he did a really nice job, you know, because one of the reasons that he chose North Dakota is not because we produce the most soybeans. We're actually fourth in the country. But there is a very large segment of the population that is, one, switching over from other crops to soybeans. And then also because in terms of presidential politics, this has been a red state for a really long time. And so he was able, what he wanted to do was say, you know, these are people who likely voted for the president and then now are very much being hurt by these policies. But then I thought in particular did just such a great job saying that these farmers, as much as they are hurt by the policy, they're very glad that they are being done, only they wish they'd have been done 30, 40 years ago. I really thought that was really respectfully done.
It is interesting. And also, you understand the perspective because, you know, these trade deals, you can argue and perhaps very successfully that the U.S. is getting a bit of a short end of the stick when it comes to some of our foreign deals. And I know that there's thought about maybe some short-term pain for some long-term gain. I've been hearing that, too.
Yeah, and his reports, one or two, have already aired on Morning Edition, and you should just check out the NPR.org website to get all of his reports. I did ask him before he left when they might air, and he said, well, you know how news goes.
Mm-hmm.
So stay tuned to NPR and to the website for when those reports will air.
I also have a prediction for you in terms of national attention on North Dakota.
Ooh.
I think we're going to see more national attention. I think we're going to see more people come here. I guess a couple of the major television networks have sent reporters here to get a taste of what's happening in the U.S. Senate race because, it's still very close if polls are to be believed. It's probably within the margin of error. B, it is a Democrat senator in a red state.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interest in that.
Well, I saw an MSNBC reporter in Divide County recently.
Right, and I happened to see that report. And interesting, they picked Divide County.
Yeah.
And that was apparently some decision that was made when they sent the reporter out here. And I think you're going to see a lot more interest in that. And remember, we had a lot of interest back in, I think, the 1996 and 2000 elections when people came to North Dakota to get a taste of what was going on.
Okay. I know a little bit in 2012, too. I
think 2012, too.
Netta Ulaby from NPR came, and,
right.
she covered when it was Heidkamp and Rick Berg.
And then 2008, when, remember, Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of spotlight in North Dakota because North Dakota Democrats went for Barack Obama instead of Hillary Clinton in their straw polls, and the party kind of bound their straw polls to the delegates at the convention, but there was an insurgency at the convention that wanted to see if, you know, they could go to Clinton's side. That was an interesting convention to cover because of the undercurrents.
Well, fun to be in the national spotlight. But let's move on to state news. The legislative committee voting to add raises to its 2019 to 2021 biennium budget request. When was the last raise for state employees?
2 years ago. Actually, it was approved 4 years ago, and the state employees have been working for the past year and a half without getting raises, and that was due to a budget issue.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even Governor Burgum is saying that state employees do deserve raises. We want to build raises in the next budget. So the legislature has to submit its own budget. So what they've done is add 2% per year for raises for their employees, and at the same time, if that's what they get, that's what state employees will get, then legislators will also get 2 and 2.
And has Burgum indicated that the budget has rebounded enough to accommodate this?
Well, this is the interesting, I think, how the budget discussions are going. He's still calling for 5 and 10% cut in spending, but he said what you need to do is make sure you have money built into the budget so we can have raises for state employees. So it puts a little bit more of an impetus about, you know, looking for efficiencies if you can find them. And there are some agencies which they're saying, you know, they're cutting into bone too. So I think 2019 is going to be a bit contentious at times.
Have we heard any talk about agencies whose budgets were cut might see some of that funding restored?
Not yet. But again, we're really in the first inning of the baseball game when it comes to how budgets are put together, because the agencies will put together the requests and they'll put together an enhanced budget for if the money is there, this is what we want. And they will submit them to the governor. The governor then will then get his OMB together, the Office of Management and Budget, and they'll come up with a budget proposal that will be presented to the legislature in the December organizational session. That's going to tell a major tale because that will put the direction toward how the discussions are going to go. And I think that the appropriations committees in both houses are going to have a lot of pen to paper when it comes down to this.
UND, NDSU, the University of South Dakota and area hospitals got a $20 million grant to work on cancer from the National Institutes of Health. And now this grant is specifically supposed to help kind of bridge that gap between research and patient care?
Right. The NIH mentioned that they like this grant because they think that there is a gap between what they call the laboratory and the bed, because some of these things are done in the laboratory, but they don't translate so well when it comes to patient care. Now, there's a commitment from all the parties together, and that's why you've got hospitals involved in this grant. They're going to try to take this research and give it practical applicability when it comes to treating patients, and they think that really you can start improving some outcomes if you come up with some ideas, some new treatments, and some new potential for stemming the tide of cancer.
Will $20 million go very far in cancer research, especially considering it's over a five-year period?
Over a five-year period, but the parties are committed to doing the work, and of course, using universities, you've got student talent too.
All right, Dave, we have exhausted our time. We'll see you again next week.
Very good. Thanks, Ashley.
Madeline is next.
This week on Away with Words, there's a word for it. We promise.
I'm looking for a more appropriate salutation that we can use that sort of reflects our times.
So dude isn't working for you?
And the word means taking pleasure in others' misfortunes.
Join us.
That's so clutch.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, there's the fanfare. It's time to talk about another movie with our movie critic, Matt Olien. Matt, you've been off to see a remake of a famous 1973 film, Papillon.
Papillon, yes. Okay. So this is another example of a film that's kind of been dumped in late summer and early fall. And this is a time of year when we're out of the summer season. We haven't quite hit our Oscar bait overdrive, which we will go into in much detail a week from today, Ashley, on our fall movie preview show. And this is a film that's not making a lot of money. It was actually finished last year. And yes, it's a remake of the 1973 film that starred Steve McQueen as Papillon, Henri Charrière, the French prisoner who eventually found his way off Devil's Island, the only person allegedly to ever escape from the French penal colony. And the original had Dustin Hoffman as his friend on the island, Louis Degas, who sort of, helps him and things like that. In this remake, we have Michael Knorr, a Danish director, taken over. Franklin Schaffner, who Oscared for Patton, was the director of the 73 film. And Charlie Hunnam from King Arthur fame, Lost City of Z, very, very good British actor, right on the cusp of being a superstar. He's kind of been rumored as one of the James Bond successors. He plays Papillon. Rami Malek plays Louis. Now, he's interesting because in the next few months, people are going to get to know who Rami Malek is. He's playing Freddie Mercury in the Bohemian Rhapsody film. And there's a lot of buzz on this film. And if it comes off, he may well be very soon an Oscar nominee or Oscar winner. As for Papillon, as I said, this is based on Henri Charrière's autobiography, which he wrote about escaping from Devil's Island. We get flashbacks to in France, 1931, when supposedly he's wrongly convicted. We're never really sure what he did, or was he actually convicted? Did he do what he did? Was he framed? That's kind of murky. But most of the scenes take place in French Guiana. Brutality, solitary confinement. He wants to escape. He's not going to play by the rules. That's the story that was told also in the 1973 film and in this film. You know, they try their best with this film, but I just wonder, his story is so interesting, his true story, and yet it hasn't made a great film yet. The 73 film is very long. It's kind of fondly remembered by people my age from seeing it on TV. But McQueen's acting skills were really pushed to the limit in that role, I felt. Hunnam is probably a little bit better suited to the role. But just like the original, it gets too long. The stakes never seem terribly high. We know what the ending's going to be because we know his autobiography. We know his story. And so it's kind of like, why was this made? Especially if it's going to get dumped at the end of summer. It's really a film that probably costs more than it's ever going to make back. It's not bad. I mean, Malek and Charlie Hunnam do their best. It's solidly produced. There's some decent scenes. There's a tacked-on ending, which I won't go into in detail, that really is completely unnecessary. I didn't care for that. So it's not a horrible film, but you're just wondering why. Why was there needed to be a remake to this film? And if so, why did they dump it into a spot where it's going to have no awards buzz or anything, probably because the film just isn't quite that good.
You did a little comparison between the two leads in the original and this remake. How about Dustin Hoffman versus Rami Malek? How would you compare those two performances?
Very similar. Malek seems to be kind of channeling Hoffman, kind of a jittery, nervous performance, the kind of performances Hoffman specialized at in his heyday. Malek's a very good actor. Like I said, he is right on the cusp of everyone knowing who he is if the Freddie Mercury film comes off. He's really, I think, the best thing in the film. I like the scenes with him and Charlie Hunnam. They form that kind of bond that they have as prisoners. He's more of the one who plays by the rules. His wife is working on his appeal. I'm going to get out of here, you know. And, of course, he's pretty naive about that as well. This was a horrible, horrible way for prisoners to be treated in these days. As you know, Ashley, it no longer exists. It was finally shut down after years of complaints and whatnot. And Charrière had a fascinating life. But it is a fascinating story, and I just don't know why it hasn't made a better film. Maybe it's because we've seen so many prison films, so many torture films, that it's like, what more can they do? But, you know, Hunnam gives his all in the part. Like I said, I hope he becomes a big star because he's right on the cusp. The King Arthur film did not come off, but the Lost City of Z film did. So, you know, people want to check it out, check your listings, but it's not going to be here very long because we're almost ready for awards bait, Oscar bait season.
So papillon in French means butterfly, yes. And the main character has a butterfly tattoo, but also butterflies often symbolize, mm-hmm. you know, sort of across belief systems. They can often symbolize freedom or rebirth. Yes, we know that he escapes from this prison, but is there a real sense? Is he ever free?
Yeah, he comes off differently than the other prisoners, where you just have a feeling he's built differently than some of the other prisoners. There's a couple escape attempts before we get finally to the one that, you know, eventually frees him that are pretty well filmed. But yeah, there is that sense of, you know, this butterfly in my chest means something. I'm free. He never wants to submit. He has no business staying there. He doesn't want to stay there. He doesn't want to do his time. And unfortunately, with him trying to escape, his time keeps getting worse and worse and longer and longer.
Yeah.
And solitary confinement, which is horrible. No light, darkness. I mean, it will try anyone, but he's a tough guy. And Charrier himself was a tough man, a tough guy. You can look him up. And, you know, whether he was framed or actually committed something to get himself there, I don't know. You can look it up and decide that for yourself. I'm not saying he was a great person or anything like that. But clearly that kind of penal system, those days are done. Those are long gone and have been pushed out.
There's a lot of talk online about the book being semi-autobiographical.
Exactly.
Is the movie presenting it as if the book is 100% true?
No, it says based on a true story.
Yeah.
So it has long been discussed what really happened with Charrier. You know, the French for years denied that he ever got off Devil's Island.
Yeah.
That he did
that
not.
That he ever went there.
Yeah, it was much discussed whether he was actually there. How did he get off? Did he actually get off? Is he making this up? You know, the autobiography came out in 1970. He passed away in 73 when the first film came out, ironically. So, yeah, it is in dispute somewhat what really happened in his life or if this is just a heck of a good yarn that he was telling. But most agree he did get off. He did escape. What he did to get there, I don't know. That's what is in dispute. And the French disputed for a long time that he ever escaped.
All right. Well, I have a trivia question. The book came out in 1969. So
69,
let's
right.
go
I said
to
70,
the
sorry.
To the 69 Oscars for films released in 1968. I'm going to try and
okay.
get you. So foreign language films, since we're talking about a foreign language book originally.
I think it was War and Peace. Did that win,
it
Ashley?
Did win.
The big
yep.
Russian film by
yep.
Sergei Bondarchuk, okay.
It did. You want to go for the other nominees?
Oh, that's a tough category. That's a category I usually can't get all of them. I think Stolen Kisses was in there, the
yep.
Francois Truffaut movie.
Yep. That's a French one.
Oh, goodness.
And there's one from Hungary, Czechoslovakia,
yeah.
and Italy.
Czechoslovakia. Was that The Fireman's Ball by Miloš Forman, who passed away this year? I'm not going to get the other two.
Okay.
That's not my strongest category, but I got three. So.
And The Boys of Paul Street and The Girl with the Pistol.
I have not seen those two. I've seen the other three.
All right. We've been in the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel of Bismarck, a full-service hotel located in downtown Bismarck. Preparing fresh Midwestern cuisine at the Terrace Restaurant or crafted cocktails and cold beer at the Off-Broadway Lounge. More information on booking your next hotel room online at radisson.com/Bismarck.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 14th. On May 18th, 1876, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and his 7th Cavalry rode west from Fort Abraham Lincoln for a summer campaign against the Lakotas, with the regimental band playing the stirring military song, Gary Owen. Custer's wife, Elizabeth, or Libby as she was known, and many soldiers' wives stood along the road to watch them go. The sad-faced wives waved a courageous farewell, smiling bravely to keep the ones they loved from knowing the anguish of their breaking hearts. It was hard to keep from despairing when the musicians played the plaintive tune, The Girl I Left Behind Me.
That became prophecy, for Custer and the soldiers who rode with him the following month on June 25th would die at the Little Bighorn. Libby Custer had known the risks since the first year of their married life in 1864, when Custer continually charged into battle during the Civil War. Protected countless times by Custer luck, her husband was untouched by enemy bullets. Still, Libby dreaded having her husband ride westward that day in 1876. She became permeated with a premonition of disaster she had never known before. On Sunday, June 25th, the wives gathered with Libby in the parlor of her large house to find comfort in singing hymns. When they sang, "Even though a cross it be, nearer my God to thee," they felt indescribable yearning for their absent husbands. The words of the hymn arose like sobs from their hearts. The deathly news came 10 days later on July 5th via the steamboat Far West. On this date in 1922, the Bismarck Tribune published an account of how Libby heard of Custer's ruin. In the early morning of July 6th, Captain William McCaskey, the fort's commander, accompanied by Surgeon J.V.D. Middleton and Lieutenant Charles Gurley, knocked on the Custer House's back door, then asked Maria, the housemaid, to summon Mrs. Custer. Libby asked, "Is there any news?" With a choked voice, Captain McCaskey said, "Yes, there is news, but bad news." When the words were uttered, "Custer and all his men are killed." She screamed and fell. Libby's life was shattered. She never remarried, always working and writing to restore Custer's tarnished reputation, living as Custer's widow to the age of almost 91. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Saturday and weekend edition, we'll hear from the Carolina coast, where Hurricane Florence brings both wind and water. How are residents and homes holding up? What kind of help will they need after the storm passes? I'm Scott Simon, the latest from the Outer Banks and beyond, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, horticulturist Ron Smith is in to take your lawn and garden questions. Go ahead and get them in early by emailing mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or by finding us on our Facebook page, Main Street at Prairie Public. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.